My name is Solvay Chesseth, and I have worked with National Namibia Concerns for the last 15 years or so. Namibia being the country that's colored yellow there on the lower part of the map. We began with Namibia back in the early 70s when Namibian pastors began coming to Wartburg Seminary and taught us, first of all, where Namibia was, and secondly, how to pronounce the name of their country. We were really entry level, I guess they say, at that time. But we have spent about 15 years coming to learn the story of Namibia, and little by little, their struggle became ours, and so we spent a lot of time at it. What I was just saying is that I will do a session on Namibia on Thursday, and then on Friday after dinner, 6:15 or 6:30, I will do a slideshow on Namibia. So those are the two presentations this week that I feel real at home with. What we are here today to talk about is South Africa's role in the destabilization of the whole region of Southern Africa. You know, we hear quite a bit about apartheid in South Africa. We hear about the homelands, the state of emergency, the detention without trial, all these things within South Africa. But very, very rarely do we hear of it's called South Africa's other war, South Africa's external war against its neighbors. And in many ways, when you think of the vastness, when you discover the magnitude of the destruction that South Africa has caused and is causing, their other war is at least as significant as what has been happening inside the country. And one of the things that I find disturbing a little bit is that in the last few years, with the Namibia Peace Accords and with some other so-called peace initiatives in the region, and certainly with de Klerk agreeing to talk with the ANC, people, especially I think political leaders in this country, are very quick to start even talking about South Africa as a peacemaker. And this sounds very, very strange to anyone who has seen up close the level of destruction, the ruthlessness, the brutality, the devastation that South Africa has wrought over the last, many, many years. So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I'm going to have to use my notes more than I usually do because, and I hope you will be patient, there are a lot of statistics in what we'll talk about today, and I don't expect you to remember the statistics themselves, and yet I will repeat some of them because I think that's the only way to get a feeling for the scope of the disaster in Southern Africa. South Africa announced in 1977, it was a public thing, it was a white paper, so-called white paper, written by P.W. Botha, who at that time was Minister of Defense for South Africa. Since then, he has been President of South Africa for a number of disastrous years. But in this white paper, he called for the coordination of the struggle, the internal struggle against the black majority in South Africa, and the external struggle against the bordering states. And he said, we need coordination in four areas: economic, military, diplomatic, and political. Now, what were the goals? We will not discuss today, and by the way, Jim Knutson is doing sessions here on South Africa, and he is a tremendous authority on South Africa. But today we're not going to talk about what has happened within the country. We're going to focus on the external aspects of this total strategy. The goals of this strategy, first of all, were to maintain the economic dependence on South Africa, to not only maintain it, but build that for these countries in the region. Now, actually, that was a goal, that has been a goal for the last 100 years. Southern Africa, in terms of the infrastructure, the rail lines, communications, and so forth, was all geared toward South Africa. So that South Africa was the key factor, and South Africa benefited, of course, economically from the minerals and from the exports of all these countries there in Southern Africa. And that was one goal, to maintain the dependence of these countries on South Africa. A second one was that increasingly, as the nations of the world came to realize what apartheid was doing, the many nations imposed embargoes against South African goods. And South Africa realized its trade market was shrinking. And so a second goal was to keep these nations as sort of a captive market for South Africa. A third goal was to destroy the model of a majority-ruled government being a successful country. I mean, for example, Botswana here. You know, it's a multiracial government, and certainly South Africa did not want its own citizens to see a black-led government succeeding. That's also true since independence in Rhodesia, you know, that became Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola. So a big goal was a psychological one, to convince its own white citizens that it would be a disaster if black majority rule were to come to South Africa. Another goal was to keep the guerrillas of the African National Congress, the ones fighting for independence or liberation in South Africa, to keep them several countries away, kind of to keep a buffer zone around South Africa. And finally, well, not finally, but of the goals that I identified today, there may be others. Another one was to convince the people in, these are called the frontline states, Angola, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania. I ran out of shading, so that's not shading. Swaziland, Lesotho. To convince the people, make their suffering so great that they decided that it is better to put up with apartheid than to continue to oppose it. And certainly South Africa has succeeded in making the suffering of the people in the frontline states something, it's compared to the Holocaust, really, in some of the countries. Okay, what are the South Africa's methods of achieving these goals? And certainly interrupt me at any time with questions or ideas or thoughts or disagreements or whatever.
Were these declared, I mean, both as stated objectives? These are documented objectives?
The stated objectives that I have seen just were the general, the coordination of internal and external efforts in the areas of military, diplomatic, economic. I'm sure that it would be possible to find, at least in the area of economic, openly stated. Mm-hmm. Okay, methods of achieving these goals. The first and foremost is to cut off the tree roots. Absolutely key to the development of any one of these countries would be their ability to export goods without going over South Africa. And so South Africa has, in the last 10 years, virtually cut the trade routes. For example, the Beira corridor, correct me on my pronunciations, Beira corridor, here in Mozambique, this big port, the rail lines there, the rail lines down to Maputo were cut. Of course, South Africa during this time totally controlled Namibia, so their big deep water port of Walvis Bay was under South African control. To cut the rail line that crossed Angola, that used to service, you know, Zambia, Zaire, and Angola. By cutting these trade routes, by repeatedly attacking and destroying the bridges, destroying the tracks, and so forth, South Africa has been able to force these countries to ship through South Africa. And that has perhaps been the largest blow economically, is this completely closing down of their import-export facilities. Secondly, South Africa imposed economic sanctions on some of these countries, trade barriers, withholding, for example, with Zimbabwe here. When the harvest was ready, they were dependent on South Africa to provide the empty train cars to come up and get their produce. And at a strategic time when the harvest is ready, South Africa would withhold the rail cars so the harvest would rot. Economic blockade of Lesotho. You see Lesotho down here, completely surrounded by South Africa. And they forced a change in the government there by simply blockading, embargoing Lesotho. This kind of economic sanctions. Sending home of the workers. Vast numbers of Mozambican workers had been employed in South African mines. And in 1987-88, these workers were sent home en masse, you know, a tremendous blow to the Mozambican economy. Then there were direct acts of aggression. South Africa has fought openly in Angola, or has had troop presence in the southern part of Angola ever since 1975. In the struggle, in terms of the Namibian struggle, this was one of the factors that one always had to deal with, was South Africa's repeated incursions into Angola. So this was a direct instance of South African Defense Force troops being present there in another country. Then raids across the borders into Lesotho, into Botswana, to going after refugees, going after leaders of the ANC, going after civilians. But this again is an example of direct aggression against their neighbors. Then the fourth way of achieving their goals was that of indirect acts of aggression, of using proxy military groups to achieve its aims. And the two major groups would be UNITA, fighting here in Angola, and RENAMO, devastating Mozambique. Both of these forces were supported by South Africa. Now, the history of RENAMO in Mozambique is kind of interesting. I have with me a video that turned out to be of such poor quality, I'm not going to use it. But it includes an interview with a man, an old Rhodesian by the name of Kenneth Flowers, who in 1977, during the Zimbabwean War for Independence, organized a group of kind of infiltrators. It was intended to find out what was going on here in Mozambique, because soldiers fighting to liberate Zimbabwe were in Mozambique. And this group fought for the last 3 years of the Rhodesian struggle. And then when Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, and here sits this British-sounding gentleman explaining that the RENAMO forces were offered the chance to have their command shifted to South Africa. And he said they jumped at the chance. Just amazing. And immediately thereafter, the leaders of RENAMO were flown to Pretoria, were given training, were given information on logistic support that South Africa would be supplying them. And they have, beginning in 1980-81, waged an absolutely devastating war on the civilians in Angola. I'll talk a little bit more about that today, but tomorrow I want to spend a whole hour on Angola and Mozambique. So today I want to just say a few words about those countries. Supposedly in 1984, Mozambique was really brought to its knees by the activity of RENAMO, the gains that people had been so happy about in the early years of independence, gains in terms of primary education and primary health care out in the provinces. For the first time, Mozambican peasants had clinics and so forth. All of this has been completely wiped out by RENAMO. And in 1984, Mozambique signed with South Africa peace agreements. And it was a terrible defeat for Mozambique. South Africa was hailed as the peacemaker. And South Africa has not, each country agreed. Mozambique said, we won't let the ANC be here trying to overthrow South Africa. South Africa said, we will end our support for RENAMO. Well, Mozambique did, and South Africa didn't. And I saw as recently as just a couple months ago, certainly all the way through till 1989, South Africa was providing support for Mozambican rebels, RENAMO. And then UNITA, this group down here that emerged in 1974, the Portuguese government in Portugal was overthrown. Portugal controlled Angola and Mozambique. And suddenly, those two countries were independent nations. And there were three groups in Angola striving for power, and UNITA was the one that was supported by South Africa, also covertly supported by the United States. And that's a whole other area of U.S. foreign policy that I thought I would get into more tomorrow. But since 1975, UNITA has fought in southern Angola and receiving, well, so far this year, $50 million in aid from the U.S. and the rest of it from South Africa. So by using these proxy forces, South Africa has destabilized the region. What are the results of this destabilization? It varies from country to country, depending on their proximity to South Africa, depending on geographical factors very often. So I thought I would go through them probably from the least affected to the most affected here. And so we start with Botswana here in the center. That's entirely a landlocked country, as you see, and therefore very vulnerable. In Botswana, the impact of this destabilization was felt in excess defense spending, more than they would normally have had to spend to defend their borders, because every now and again South Africa would launch a commando raid into Botswana. Transport disruption. It's estimated that that alone has cost Botswana $350 million during the period of 1980 to 89. The total loss to the gross domestic product of Botswana is for that period estimated at $500 million. And the books that I read say that does not touch the psychological damage in Botswana has been, especially for these Rongabarone, the feeling of constant vulnerability has badly affected, especially the children in that area. But financially and so forth, Botswana has probably, of the frontline states, lost the least. Then we look at Swaziland here, this tiny little bit of country. One of the losses to Swaziland is, here is this, remember I mentioned the Mozambican port of Maputo? Right there, they used to ship by rail, their rail lines to Maputo were cut, making it very difficult, or much more expensive to export. And then there was a large dam, you have to get the name of it, Kahora Basa? How am I doing?
Kahora Basa.
Yeah. So, have you folks met Janelle De Grucci? Here I am talking about South Africa with a South African sitting here who's on the staff here at Holden. So my pronunciations will just make you wince. But this huge dam, and it had been counted on to provide electricity to that whole area. That has been sabotaged and the electricity cut off. Now one benefit for Swaziland, and this in the things I've read, this is the only place really that I've come to a benefit for anybody out of this, and that is that South Africa began to use Swaziland as a place through which to export or import by changing the labels or whatever it was able to get around the boycotts or the embargoes against South African by running it through the country there of Swaziland. So that's a benefit. You mustn't neglect to mention if we find a benefit. So the total, it's estimated the total loss in terms of the gross domestic product for Swaziland is about $200 million over this period. And that's significant when you consider the resources and the size of the country. Then we look to Lesotho down here. That is, as I said, completely surrounded by South Africa. That does not have apparently much of an economic base at all. It is entirely dependent. The workers in Lesotho work in South Africa. And that's why by closing the borders there, South Africa is able to just squeeze Lesotho because they don't have the internal resources. The total loss there is figured at $250 million, plus a very heightened sense of vulnerability, especially since the blockade time. Okay, Tanzania, up here. Now, the one that I didn't have marker for. This is located a long way from South Africa. It is a frontline state because when the frontline states first organized, Mozambique was a colony of Portugal. So Tanzania is up there, and it has paid dearly for its solidarity with these other countries. In terms of excess military budget, it has done a good bit of assistance militarily in Mozambique in fighting against the Renamo terrorists. In losses of export, that it used to do a fairly good export business to these other countries, but several of them are now so poor they can't buy the products. And then refugees. Tanzania has absorbed a lot of refugees. Refugees from basically from Mozambique, but also from Namibia and also from South Africa. And in Tanzania is where we begin to talk about excess deaths. The excess deaths are the portion of the death rate that is above what it would be expected to be if the war of destabilization weren't occurring. And in Tanzania in 1988, they estimated among the refugees, and you know, when refugees flock in, of course, and you have a limited number of resources, the general level of malnutrition goes up, of medical care goes down. But they estimated 10,000 in 1988 alone. The cost to Tanzania has been estimated at $1.25 billion over from 1980 to 89. So you can see it's getting more and more expensive. And these are countries that, you know, during these years, these are the first nation-building years of these independent nations, so it's been a terrible setback. Zambia has paid for its resistance to apartheid in terms of excess defense costs. It's got some very vulnerable borders. In terms of transportation losses, it used to send its products straight across to Beira through the Beira corridor. I did better that time. You know, and now it has had to since that has been cut, it has had to export most of its stuff through South Africa. In 1988, this rail line up through Tanzania was improved, and it has begun to export there, but it has paid a lot in terms of lost exports, and then it costs so much more to get your goods to market. But basically what the impact on Zambia has been refugees. 250,000 refugees in Zambia, and there they figure the indirect war deaths, the excess deaths, again at 50,000 people. The gross domestic product loss at nearly $5 billion. Again, here is a terribly poor country. Malawi. See this little yellow strip here. Again, a landlocked nation, a poor nation. it lost 90% of its trade routes and is forced again to go the long way around to South Africa. It has had just a tidal wave of Mozambican refugees, 700,000 by the middle of 1989. That's in a population of 7.5 million people, so they're, it's a huge drain on the population. And then they had drought and bad harvests in 1987 and 88, and the levels of malnutrition went way up. And they estimated 25,000 infant and child deaths alone, that's excluding the others, because of the combination of lowered $1 million, which was a third of their gross domestic product that year. Overall, it's estimated $215 billion has been the cost for Malawi. Then in Zimbabwe, Zimbabwe has experienced economic sanctions. I mentioned the railway cars that didn't arrive when they needed them, an oil embargo on the part of South Africa, and then commando raids. Oil refineries have been blown up, and certainly attacks on the transportation system. Their excess defense spending was running $3 million each year by 1988. Loss of trade routes, I mentioned that. I mean, that's just such I keep saying that, but it's true for all of them. You know, they couldn't get their things out in the usual ways. And so Zimbabwe has, for the past several years, worked very hard to open this Vira corridor. It has spent millions of dollars and lots of Zimbabwean lives on trying to patrol that train line. The bill for defense costs and trade costs was a billion in 1988, and that exactly equaled the government deficit for that year. So if they hadn't had the war to deal with, Zimbabwe's economy would be growing. They have about 175,000 refugees living in Zimbabwe. And again, the big figure of $8 billion in gross domestic product. And then we come to the last two that I just will talk a little bit about today, because tomorrow I want to talk a little more about the history and what's happening in Angola and Mozambique. But next, Angola here. The war against the Angolan people has just really been devastating. Again, the sabotage of the transportation routes. Almost all transport within the whole country of Angola has ground to a halt. It's just military things that move any place in Angola. The rail systems have been almost completely destroyed. And then rural terrorism has forced the farmers from their land, forced the production to stop. This is attacks by UNITA guerrillas on population, and particularly in Angola, the use of landmines in the fields and on the paths along the villages. Angola has now the very dubious distinction of being the amputee capital of the world. Over 40,000 people have lost their arms or legs in Angola during this decade. It's developing the very dubious distinction of having one of the largest artificial limb centers in the world now is in Angola. the people, but that completely shuts down a country. About 75% of the water systems in these little villages, in the rural areas, have been either damaged or destroyed. So here are all these people without water, without crops. And now this used to be, Angola used to be called the breadbasket of southern Africa, because it's a country that should be very fertile, very good for growing crops. And instead, there's famine and hunger. Right now also they are dealing with a drought, especially in southern Angola. So those folks are coming down across the border into Namibia looking for food. At least a fourth of the clinics and the little schools in the outlying areas, at least a fourth of them have been destroyed by UNITA. Defense spending has been $8.5 billion, equal to half of all government spending. So all of their resources are going into this. Over 500,000 people have been killed. Well, that's 500,000. And of these, it's estimated that the 40% or so have been children. This is a little over 5.5% of the entire population have been killed now in this war. And gross domestic product losses again at $27 billion. And I just can't imagine numbers or figures like this, but when you think of an emerging nation, a nation trying to put together all of its systems and get going, to have to have spent half of its government expenditures on the war has been just a tremendous setback, to say the least. And then the terror in the countryside from all these civilian deaths is monumental. But then we come to Mozambique, across here, and the suffering there has been even greater than in Angola. For one reason, Mozambique is poorer than Angola. It does not have some of the resources. For example, Angola has this oil. Which American company is it? We've got huge oil refineries in Angola.
Is it
Gulf? I don't know. It might be Gulf. But, Angola does have resources, and Mozambique really was lacking. It was much poorer to start with, and so the margin for survival for all these people is much narrower. The degree of damage is greater. Mozambican trade routes were absolutely key to this whole region of Africa, and so they have been the primary targets. But the third reason for the devastation in Angola and the devastating effect it has had on the Angolan people is that the terror, the Bairanamo, is even more horrifying than what UNITA has been doing with the landmines. It's, I don't know if you can compare brutalities, but certainly the Renamo forces, they're infamous for the terrible dismemberment of people, cutting off of noses and ears, and children being forced to kill their parents, and it's just absolutely beyond the scope of imagination what has happened to the people, what has been done to them by the Renamo terrorists. I was at a meeting in Sweden a few years ago, and some folks there who have been working with Mozambique all their lives were, in such sorrow, really, over what has happened to that country after the promising beginnings, the first few years. It was just such a heady thing to be in an independent Mozambique and the clinics and the schools and everything that were getting set up. And then this tremendous devastation that has come. And these folks were saying, you know, it's almost ungovernable. And now I'm blocking. It's only the President Michelle that can hold it together at all. This very charismatic leader of Mozambique. They said he is the only person that, you know, we have any, that gives it, us any hope. And the next day we heard he had been killed in a very mysterious plane crash. For some reason his plane flew into South Africa and crashed. And I still have not heard whether they have definitely, the assumption was very strongly that it was South work by South Africa. But I mean, the folks at the meeting I was at, it was just despair. Now, the leader that has taken his place has proven to be, though not charismatic and a totally different personality, just kind of quiet and so forth, and is doing his best, but it's a question whether Mozambique can come back, even if South Africa were to stop today. It will be generations before the damage can be repaired. The measurable costs in Mozambique, the excess military is figured at $325 million a year, and does not even begin to fight off RENAMO, and that's why it has taken aid from these neighboring countries, military aid. Nearly a complete breakdown in the social structures. Almost a half of Mozambicans are refugees, 50% of the people are refugees. Tremendous food shortages because, again, the farmers are not able to be out in the fields. The RENAMO guerrillas have focused on schools, clinics, and then the peasants that would supply the food. There have been nearly 1 million war-related deaths. That's 6% of Mozambican population has died. Nearly half of these deaths were children under the age of 5. So that's a lot of little children. 250,000 children are orphaned or separated from their parents. 300,000 to 500,000 children have been what they call war traumatized. Traumatized by what they've been through. They've either been mutilated themselves, they've had to be present while family members were tortured and murdered. Kidnapped by RENAMO, that's one of the things that RENAMO has done. Kidnap children and force them to fight and kill. Or they would be themselves killed. There are a number, every once in a while I read, of medical and psychiatric people in this country going to Mozambique. People wanting, first of all, it's experimental. How do you deal with children who have been so severely traumatized? But also it's not only experimental, but it's an attempt to be of service to a few of the children to deal with the results of what they have been through. The gross domestic product loss, $15 billion. In 1988, the loss for gross domestic product was 110% of the gross domestic product. So it's just mind-boggling. In 1988, the U.S. State Department, one of the officials there, called it one of the most brutal holocausts against ordinary people since World War II, what has happened to the people of Mozambique. So this then is a kind of a summary, and as I say, I don't expect you to remember the statistics, the figures, but to just get a sense of the tremendous price that has been paid by people in these frontline states, the price of their refusal to accept the system of apartheid. And you know, we never hear about it. That's something to look at, look for in your newspapers. And see, yes.
Our public radio has covered some of Mozambique.
Absolutely.
And maybe, I think, one real major thing I heard, but that's one place.
Yeah, Mozambique, in 1988, a State Department guy named Gersony visited some of the Mozambican refugee camps and wrote a report of what he had found. And I think that was terribly valuable because right at that time, Senator Jesse Helms was pushing for us to give aid to RENAMO. We should start sending RENAMO money. So far, as far as we know, we have not done that. Whereas we do give aid to UNITA. Somehow the Angola has not been able to get the same kind of attention or maybe attract the same kind of support from other countries as Mozambique. But yes, that's right. Watch, listen to public radio because every now and again.
They commented about the money the Portuguese also support, that many of the people who left Mozambique when independence was given helped start RENAMO.
Yeah, well,
and that they really supported it, and how devastating that was, that they were willing to put money into destroying it.
Into destruction.
Yeah. And talked about the forces in Mozambique as being truly anarchistic, and it's to the point where there's no goal but to destroy, to utterly destroy.
You know, that has been one of the real strong criticism is not right, but condemnation of RENAMO is that it has not had a political platform. It has not tried to be installed as the political party. Now, just this summer, and I don't have any news after sort of mid-July, but the president of Mozambique, I think as early as March or so, started talking about being willing to negotiate with RENAMO. This is a real switch. Chissano said, in fact, and I could hardly imagine this, and I'm curious to read more about why he would say it, these are our brothers in the bush. A tremendous statement to make toward people who have been this brutal. But there were in June scheduled meetings between representatives of the government of Mozambique and RENAMO. That did not ever happen. But on July 11th or 12th, representatives of these two groups did meet in Rome and were scheduled to meet now in early August. And I don't know if that has happened or if where it sits. I don't know. Does anyone know? I haven't seen anything in the papers since I have come up here. But part of the reason, I think Chissano has also been brought to his knees. You know, there's a limit. And now if RENAMO would come up with people, you know, its leaders really were. There was nobody that you could deal with. It was strictly destruction and terror for so many years. Other comments, sir?
Are the soldiers of RENAMO Mozambican, primarily?
Yes, yeah.
The same as UNITA is with Angola.
Right, yeah.
So they're local people that are being involved in doing, committing these atrocities.
The people call them the armed bandits. The bandits in the bush, the armed bandits. Certainly there has been direction from non-Mozambicans, you know, all the way along. The command structure was transferred from the Rhodesian forces to South Africa. But yes, the people committing the atrocities have been Mozambicans, some of whom have been forced to do this, as in the kidnapping of villagers, and then it was you kill or you are will be killed. We've seen some footage, you know, some videos of former Renamo fighters who said, this is what we did, you know, we killed first community leaders. We would gather the people together and they would tell us who are the teachers, who are the leaders, and those we killed first, and then just sitting there telling, this is what we did. And he said, if we didn't do this, we were killed. So
by the officers of the
units.
Is Zaire in any way affected to any degree by what's happening?
Well, my assumption is Zaire would be affected by the transportation route. I assume, Zaire has been a close friend of the United States. Mobutu is one of our allies, and just how much they have suffered as a direct result, I really don't know. Zaire is a whole other story. It's very sad things coming out of Zaire.
We have a young doctor and his wife and two children. They're going there next month in the southwestern part.
Is that right? Well, it was through the air bases here that we, the United States, have supplied the UNITA forces. And now I just read, so that is certainly, in that way, they have definitely been involved in the Angolan situation. We flew our big transport planes in and out, giving aid, sending advisors and equipment down to Jamba, which was the headquarters for UNITA. Do you know if otherwise Zaire has been involved in this?
No, I mean, I would say Mobutu is not a threat to South Africa at all. Like, you know, Chissano or Simon Michelle was a Mozambique, or Mugabe, or, you know, the other frontline states. I mean, it's a completely different type of government.
They see him as an acceptable.
Well, after you left Zimbabwe, and I was still there at the Kentucky Hotel and talking to the man, Tony Mzinga, who was head of the Council of Churches in Angola for a long time, he said he was absolutely sure that, is that Kamina Air Base there, upstairs? United States was helping a stage a UNITA threat from there up in that north east part of Angola that forms there, so in that area.
In this whole area, as well as down
stage
here.
A threat to Rwanda. And there's no proof of that, but every once in a while that rumor comes up.
Well, there has been proof in that two U.S. soldiers died in a plane crash on the way to Jamba. And it wasn't a tourist.
But I meant no proof that they were staging to threaten Rwanda.
Oh.
But you get that rumor again and again and again. So something is going on in Zaire that has to do with U.S. continued aid to UNITA. That much you're sure of.
Yeah.
But beyond that, you don't know.
I just saw an interesting article about the increase. when South Africa agreed to the peace accords that eventually led to the independence of Namibia, one of the requirements was that they discontinue their aid to UNITA. And sadly enough, the U.S. picked up that portion of aid to UNITA. But I just saw an interesting thing that a number of charter planes, planes you can rent, are currently, from South Africa, are currently in Angola at the UNITA area. And the feeling is that South Africa has once more resumed its support for UNITA, which is interesting in the midst of the so-called peace progress right now in South Africa, that they would have picked that up again. So, more questions.
I think we're in Angola because we're against the Marxist, quote, government. This would probably change now because the Marxist government would not be receiving as much, at least expect not as much support from
the Soviet
Cuba
Union
and
has,
Union.
The Soviet Union has, in the last 3 or 4 years, made it clear to the liberation movements of these countries, the people fighting for their freedom, that it can no longer be expected to provide the military support that it has been. And that's certainly one of the factors behind the Namibian peace accords, mm-hmm. is that they would like these liberation movements to use political means. But yes, as the East-West, these countries were pawns, really, in the East-West struggle. Namibia was certainly held hostage for 10 years because of our U.S. foreign policy goal of getting the Cubans out of Angola. I mean, it was a very much upfront, we will not allow peace, we will not allow free elections in Namibia until the Cubans go home. And the Namibian people felt really taken hostage by that. So they've been pawns in this East-West struggle. And hopefully some of that factor is now disappearing somewhat.
If you take the Soviet Union out of there, then how does the resistance get funded?
Good question.
Maybe it won't.
Yeah, in terms now, the ANC has said that it has ended its military efforts. The Namibia thing is quiet now. Angola is trying to go it alone against UNITA, which is, it still gets some Soviet aid, but not anything like it used to. And we continue to. This summer, Bush asked for another $15 to $20 million on top of the $50 million in aid to UNITA. So that's
a question that's hard. I don't know. Is there any help from Zimbabwe and Zambia and Botswana for Angola, for the government of Angola? I've never thought to ask that before. Do you know?
I don't know.
You don't.
I think Zimbabwe has its plate full trying to help Mozambique because they help with soldiers and with money and by caring for refugees and so forth. I don't know, poor Angola is sort of over there on the other end without...
It doesn't sound like the international pressure on South Africa has really accomplished much in these southern African countries as far as trying to have South Africa back off at all.
Well, certainly where we are in South Africa today is, I believe, due in the first part to the determination of the South African people and the pressures that internally have been brought on the government. But also I think the isolation of South Africa to the extent that it has been isolated, and the arms embargo to the extent that it was observed, and the sanctions have played a role, certainly in its impact, A, on the economy within South Africa, and then B, on probably the morale. I mean, it has to feel at a certain point that it is somewhat isolated.
The isolation probably makes it more aggressive in these countries to...
One of the reasons for some of this was to keep these countries as markets if no one else will buy from them. And to keep the money that goes, you know, the money that Mozambique used to get for its transport and its port now has all been coming into the pockets of South Africans. But that's certainly an argument, and I hear it over and over again from people that we should not relax the sanctions yet. The game is not over until it's over. And if anything, we should be trying to increase the pressure now when it would do the most good. But I guess I have to say that even having read for a number of years about Southern Africa, I did not realize the enormity of the damage to these surrounding nations. The question whether, for example, Angola or Mozambique can ever come back in terms of their whole structures being destroyed. Yes.
You know, I was reading, you've done, yeah, what I've done. What is there any hard evidence at all, or any straws in the wind, that the clerk